fall. Baby, it's not mine. Not chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make dab in the middle of it. Grass make dab in the middle. We are grass make dab.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. We're going to start this program off this evening with some news, breaking news from Project Veritas, James O'Keefe. And what he did was, he had a man at CNN that came to him a while back and said, hey, give me a camera. I'm going to go back and start getting some footage and doing some recordings about this bias that exists at CNN against Trump, and especially the fact that they were concentrating on this impeachment charge against Trump. So anyway, we're going to start off with a clip of that, and it's pretty well self-explanatory, except we're going to put the full clip up. This is just a short version of it up on our site so that you'll be able to come in to thesecrettruth.com and see the whole thing, both the video and audio. But anyway, let's start off with that right now. This is Project Veritas with an insider recording dirt on CNN and their bias against Trump, and especially their bias towards getting this impeachment charge done against President Trump. Here we go now.
And then
morning, everybody. Okay, let's start with Washington, please. I don't care about the other stuff in the event. Okay, I don't care about them. Let's just stay very focused on impeachment.
My name is Kerry Porch. I'm a satellite uplink technician. I'm a contractor at the CNN Washington, D.C. Bureau.
But Jeff Zucker, yeah, basically president of CNN, has a personal vendetta against Trump. It's not going to be positive for Trump. He hates him. He's going to be negative.
I decided to wear a hidden camera.
Media created this monster.
I decided to secretly record the 9 a.m. rundown call meetings, and it's basically run by Jeff Zucker, the president of CNN.
We're moving towards impeachment. I mean, don't, we shouldn't pretend, this is going one way, and so all these moves are moves towards impeachment.
When I came to work at CNN, I mean, it was my dream job, and that dream actually just turned into a nightmare.
So I just want to say on the Instagram front, I know that there's a lot of people at CNN that are friendly with Instagram. Time to knock that off, and it's time to call them out.
I think what's going on in America now is really fundamentally the result of years of fake news. Nonsense from Fox News.
He was calling Fox News fake news and a propaganda machine, and with what I saw, I'm like, that's pretty much what CNN was. Like, it's just pumping out propaganda.
The fake conspiracy nonsense that Fox has spread for years is now deeply embedded in American society, and frankly, that is destructive to America. And I do not think we should be scared to say so.
I just want them to own where they're at. Like, hey, if we lean left, cool. Let's just say we lean left. If we lean right, let it be known. But, it just dovetails back in that thing. I just want people to have the information to make up their own minds.
He's known Trump for a long time. Like, they worked together back during The Apprentice.
And hates his guts.
He's the story. I know we're going to feel a tendency to think we're doing too much. But it's the story.
He sold himself to the devil.
start the
anti-Trump crusade.
Man, what was it like the morning after this past election?
But that day, like, man, just at 6 a.m. in the morning when I came in, like, the mood was just so sourpuss the whole day. It was a f***ing dreary day. And then at Fox, it was, like, euphoria.
CNN likes to call itself the most trusted name in news, but that's not the story we heard from a CNN insider who blew the whistle, recorded everything, and came to Project Veritas earlier this year. Would it be fair to say that you being here today is not politically motivated?
That's correct. It's not politics that motivates me. It's basically me wanting the news to be what they used to be, news, and not a infotainment or a game show or chasing the ratings like CNN purports it to be, facts first, and that's clearly not the case.
Kerry Porch has worked for CNN for 2 years. He says when he started, he had high hopes for the job, but he quickly became disillusioned as he was exposed to rampant anti-Trump bias at the network.
I noticed after, again, this is fairly rapidly after I started, within the first 3 to 6 months, that there was a strong groupthink that permeated through the halls, and that everyone was on board the, you know, I hate Trump train, or I want to, you know, basically go after anyone, you know, on the center or on the right politically.
Porch secretly recorded several of CNN's 9 a.m. morning editorial calls where CNN's president Jeff Zucker leads the anti-Trump charge.
We're moving towards impeachment. I mean, don't, like, you know, we shouldn't pretend, oh, this is going one way, and so all these moves are moves towards impeachment. So don't lose sight of what the big story is.
They're done every day, Monday through Friday, and it's basically run by Jeff Zucker, the president of CNN from the New York Bureau, and he would basically, you know, he runs it with an iron fist, and it's actually respectable. It's like listening to him run his business. It's kind of fascinating. But hearing that from the strongest and most prominent voice, you know, the number one, is on every day just hammering Trump in some way, shape, or form, or Republicans in general, about, you know, yeah, all these other stories might be happening, but we want to divert all our resources to this aspect of Trump or that aspect of Trump, or most recently, it's just all about impeachment, 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 impeachment.
On the calls are the top leadership of the network, Zucker, CNN's president, Virginia Moseley, CNN's senior vice president of news gathering.
There's a second whistleblower, and that this now fortifies the complaint.
And David Jalian, vice president and CNN political director.
I think as big of a story as what President Trump has done here is the Republicans sort of either delusional or defiant or silent responses. I think it's as big a story in what is going on.
On the calls to executive producers and news staffers across the country, it is clear that Zucker wants his network to stay focused on impeachment and nothing else.
If you noticed on that clip about the Project Veritas exposing of the CNN bias, you'll see that Jeff Zucker accuses Fox News Network of putting out fake news and conspiratorial types of things. Well, we're going to play a little bit of just some recent comments by Hillary Clinton charging Tulsi Gabbard with being a Russian asset. Now, this gets a little tricky. We're going to play this first clip that has a sort of a brief panel discussion, and then we're going to get into a Tucker clip, and then we're going to end with Van Jones and what he thinks. So we're going to play about 3 clips in here, but I'll prep each and every one of them. This one is coming up next, and it was a little panel discussion of what some of these news reporters think about Hillary Clinton's recent blurting out of this Russian asset. I think she accused Jill Stein of being a Russian asset and also Tulsi Gabbard. Here we go with that clip right now of Hillary Clinton making these accusations.
Hillary Clinton is suggesting that Russians are grooming a 2020 Democratic presidential hopeful to run as a third-party candidate and spoil the race for the Democrats. Take a listen to her remarks in a new podcast from David Plouffe.
I'm not making any predictions, but I think they've got their eye on somebody who's currently in the Democratic primary. and are grooming her to be the third party candidate. She's a favorite of the Russians. They have a bunch of sites and bots and other ways of supporting her so far.
Now, when asked if Clinton was referring to Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard, Democrat of Hawaii, Clinton's spokesman said, quote, if the nesting doll fits, he added, quote, if the Russian propaganda machine, both their state media and their bot and troll operations, is backing a candidate aligned with their interests, that is just a reality. It is not speculation. Nia, I mean, just because they have, she has views that might align with Russia on some matters, including Syria, for example, is that really responsible for Hillary Clinton to say she's a Russian asset, like something out of the movie Red Sparrow?
Right, and something off of sort of social media in the Twitterverse, too, as well, because this is what you hear. You know, if you're on Twitter, this is a lot of the conversation around Tulsi Gabbard from many Democrats who do see that she, or feel like she is something of a spoiler in this race, that her views align with Russia in many ways. But it is. It's surprising coming from Hillary Clinton in many ways. But again, I mean, she went through this in 2016. I think part of her strategy here is to say there are always these things that could be going on in this election that we didn't pay attention to in 2016, and she's sort of raising sort of the warning signs going forward for what might happen in 2020. I mean, that is sort of a charitable view of what she could be doing.
So Gabbard just tweeted a response. Let me read it. She said, quote, great, thank you, Hillary Clinton. You, the queen of warmongers, embodiment of corruption and personification of the rot that has sickened to the Democratic Party for so long, have finally come out from behind the curtain. From the day I announced my candidacy, there has been a concerted campaign to destroy my reputation. We wondered who was behind it and why. Now we know it was always you, through your proxies and powerful allies in the corporate media and war machine, afraid of the threat I pose. It's now clear that this primary is between you and me. Don't cowardly hide behind your proxies. Join the race directly. Now, there is a bigger foreign policy debate to be had, and Tulsi Gabbard very aggressively talks about ending the forever war. She's a veteran. She has standing to say that. Now she's saying, Hillary Clinton, you're behind the smear campaign against me. Join the race. It's you against me.
Yeah, so they're not friends right now. Listen, Gabbard's statement is a little overwrought, but she has every right to defend herself. A former Secretary of State is declaring her to be a Russian asset. That is deeply unfair. And if you have a problem with the way that Donald Trump smears people, well, you need to take a look at Hillary Clinton, because what she just did to Tulsi is no better than what Donald Trump does to people all the time.
And Hillary Clinton goes on, Nayara, to suggest that Putin has compromising dirt on President Trump. And so what do you make of that?
Well, we do know that Russians writ large do look for opportunities to peel off third-party candidates, so as the Jill Stein challenges, and that individual states can turn on 1 or 2 percentage points. So I think there's a broader question of how Russia is going to look to take advantage of 2020 and instill its own version of chaos, 2.0.
Mueller, I don't think, was able to find any evidence of this rumor that the Russians have anything. But I'll tell you, all this discord, I'm not blaming this on anybody in this country, but Putin, I'm sure, loves this.
Of course they do. This is exactly what they did lay out in the Mueller report, just how much they like to sow disinformation. That's why when Hillary Clinton makes a claim like this, there are valid critiques of Tulsi Gabbard, but to say something like this, it just makes you wonder.
Well, just bring the evidence if you have it, and if not, don't say it.
And don't say it on
Russian
background.
Asset.
She didn't say it. She couldn't even confirm it in her own words that it was Tulsi she was referencing. An aide confirmed it in a background statement.
She's going to own it now.
That was an enemy right there speaking in that little panel discussion. Normally, they'd be down on Trump and everybody else. And actually, they were pretty favorable in their views against what Hillary had said. Now, coming up next is a Tucker Carlson interview, a one-on-one that he had with Tulsi Gabbard after this big flap with Hillary, accusing her of being a Russian asset. So here we go with Tucker interviewing Tulsi Gabbard. Here we go now.
Hillary Clinton's campaign invented the Russia hoax, so it's not surprising that she will say just about anything about her enemies. During a recent podcast, Clinton claimed that both Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein and another unnamed Democrat are, in fact, Russian agents. Listen.
Making any predictions, but I think they've got their eye on somebody who's currently in the Democratic primary and are grooming her to be the third party candidate. She's a favorite of the Russians. They have a bunch of sites and bots and other ways of supporting her so far. And that's assuming Jill Stein will give it up, which she might not, because she's also a Russian asset.
Hillary didn't name the Democratic Manchurian candidate, but it wasn't hard to guess who she meant. She was talking about Congressman Tulsi Gabbard of Hawaii. Now, Nick Merrill, who's Hillary's spokesman, confirmed that interpretation. He said, quote, "If the nesting doll fits, this is not some outlandish claim. This is reality," end quote. Keep in mind, this is the very same Nick Merrill who warned Ronan Farrow not to expose Harvey Weinstein's sex crimes. So consider that for context. Earlier today, Congressman Gabbard tweeted a response. Here's what she wrote. "Thank you, Hillary Clinton. You, the queen of warmongers, the embodiment of corruption, the personification of the rot that has sickened the Democratic Party for so long, have finally come out from behind the curtain. It's now clear that this primary is between you and me. Don't cowardly hide behind your proxies. Join the race directly," end quote. Congresswoman Gabbard is on the road campaigning tonight and joins us, I believe, from Iowa. Congresswoman, woman, thank you very much for coming on.
Thanks, Tucker.
So just to the factual point first, are you a Russian sleeper cell?
Look, here, let me tell you what this is about. This is about Hillary Clinton sending a very strong message saying that because I am and have long been calling for an end to our country's foreign policy of waging one regime change war after the next, the likes of which we've seen in Iraq, in Libya, and ongoing in Syria, and because I'm calling for an end to this new Cold War and nuclear arms race, that I am a Russian asset and that I am a traitor to the nation that I love. And not only are they saying that about me, they are basically saying, sending this message out to every veteran in this country, every service member, every American, anyone watching at home who is fighting for peace and who is calling for an end to these regime change wars, this new Cold War and arms race. They are saying that you are also a Russian asset, that you are also a traitor to this country. That's really what's happening here.
But to call someone, I mean, it's one thing to say, I disagree with you, I think you're wrong, you know, you're crazy even. But to say you're betraying your country, and by the way, I should remind our viewers, you're a veteran. But that any American is betraying his or her country is a different level. I've never heard anybody at Hillary Clinton's level say something like that.
And the reason why she's doing this is because ultimately she knows that she can't control me. That I stand against everything that she represents. And that if I'm elected president, if I'm the Democratic nominee and elected president, that she won't be able to control me, she won't be able to manipulate me, she won't be able to continue to work from behind the curtain to continue these regime change wars that have been so costly. Thousands of my brothers and sisters in uniform were killed in Iraq, a war that she championed. Their blood is on her hands. I am calling for an end to these regime change wars. This is why she's speaking out strongly and smearing my character and trying to undermine my campaign. And just as she is doing this to me, this is what will happen to anybody who's doing the same.
Yeah, well, I've certainly noticed that. But I will say it's not just Hillary Clinton. So one of our producers pulled together a quick list here. Samantha Power, who was one of the chief foreign policy advisors to President Obama, has also gone after you. National security analysts from CNN and MSNBC have joined in. It's almost like the Washington foreign policy establishment may not like Hillary Clinton, but they're united with her on this question.
Yeah, well, this is something that happened from literally the day I announced my candidacy for president. As I said in my tweet earlier, it's become very clear now who's behind it and why. And it is Hillary Clinton and her proxies, the warmongering foreign policy establishment, who are conducting this coordinated smear campaign. And now we know exactly why. It's because I am standing up and speaking out strongly against the Hillary Clinton legacy, the warmongering legacy of waging these regime change wars, continuing to escalate these tensions between the United States, nuclear armed countries like Russia and China, this nuclear arms race, bringing more profits to the military industrial complex. As president, I will end these counterproductive policies, these regime change wars, this new Cold War and arms race, and redirect our taxpayer dollars back towards serving the needs of our people right here at home. So I want to send a message, Tucker, to your viewers here tonight. whether you're Democrat, Republican, Independent, Libertarian, whoever you are, if you are sick and tired of Hillary Clinton's warmongering policies and corruption, come and join our campaign. We need your support. You can join us at Tulsi2020.com.
You think, I got to ask you a final political question. In your response to her, you said, make it explicit, get in the race. Any indication she will?
Yes.
She has been publicly speaking a lot recently. Do you think that's real?
I don't know. We'll see. But for her to come out and actually speak for herself, come out from behind the curtain and stop using these proxies, then it will again become clear that this is a race between Hillary Clinton and myself. And voters will be given a very clear choice, a clear choice between choosing Hillary Clinton and all that she represents and continuing these warmongering policies and corruption, or supporting me and my candidacy and the leadership that I seek to bring as a Democrat to take our Democratic Party back so it is a party of, by, and for the people, a party that's fighting for peace, fighting for the people, fighting to protect our planet, and to lead our country forward, to bring people together around our unifying principles and freedoms and who we are as Americans.
And enough with the McCarthyite nonsense. It's really unbelievable. Congressman, thanks so much. Tulsi Gabbard joining us tonight live. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
This thing is not going to go away that easy for Hillary because it's showing her as on the fanatical side. Van Jones, who has self-described himself as a Marxist communist in the past, has something to say about this recent remark that Hillary Clinton said, describing Gabbard as an Russian asset. But here we go with just a short clip of Van Jones's opinion.
Tonight, Hillary Clinton pushes her own Russia conspiracy theory. In a recent podcast, Clinton says Russians are grooming a 2020 presidential contender. That candidate is Tulsi Gabbard. Here's Hillary Clinton.
I'm not making any predictions, but I think they've got their eye on somebody who's currently in the Democratic primary and are grooming her to be the third party candidate. She's a favorite of the Russians. They have a bunch of sites and bots and other ways of supporting her so far. And that's assuming Jill Stein will give it up, which she might not because she's also a Russian asset.
Okay, so just a fact, huh? Tulsi Gabbard's a Russian asset and Jill Stein's a Russian asset. Out front now, Van Jones, host of the Van Jones Show. So that's how she puts it out there. I mean,
she's playing a very dangerous game. I mean, Hillary Clinton, if you're concerned about disinformation, if you're concerned what the Russians do is they spread disinformation and get us divided against each other, that is what just happened. Just throw out some information, disinformation, smear somebody. She is Hillary Clinton. She's a legend. She's going to be in the history books. She's a former nominee of our party, and she just came out against a sitting U.S. congresswoman, a decorated war veteran, and somebody who's running for the nomination of our party with just a complete smear and no facts.
She called her a Russian asset as a fact. And as you point out, sitting U.S. Congresswoman.
A sitting U.S. Congresswoman. Now, this is a very, very dangerous game. And there's a backstory here. And there's two sides to every story. Let's not forget, Tulsi Gabbard was picked out by the Democratic Party establishment and put at the top of the DNC. They thought she was going to be their golden girl. And she got in that position in the DNC, and she looked around. She saw Debbie Wasserman Schultz and other people, Clinton allies, doing stuff they shouldn't have been doing in the primary. And Tulsi publicly quit and then endorsed Bernie Sanders. And it's been payback hell ever since.
And that's what we are here.
But payback hell ever since.
Gabbard's responded with a tweet storm. She says, thank you, Hillary Clinton. You, the queen of warmongers, embodiment of corruption and personification of the rot that has sickened the Democratic Party for so long, have finally come out from behind the curtain. From the day I announced my candidacy, there has been a concerted campaign to destroy my reputation. We wondered who was behind it and why. Now we know it was always you. Through your proxies and powerful allies in the corporate media and war machine, afraid of the threat I pose, it's now clear this primary is between you and me. Don't cowardly hide behind your proxies. Join the race directly.
Yeah, you know, getting kind of hot. It's getting kind of hot. And this is the problem. You know, we're headed down this spiral staircase. You know, you had a Pelosi and Trump. They had a big blow up there. Whoever you blame. You can't be proud of America when you have food fights breaking out in the White House between the top leadership. You can't be proud when we can't have a primary without the former nominee jumping on a podcast, throwing out aspersions, and then we're in a tweet war. This, we got real problems in America. But I'm telling you, Hillary Clinton is playing a very dangerous game. I do not want somebody of her stature to legitimate these kind of tactics against anybody. If you've got real evidence, come forward with it. But if you're just going to smear people casually on podcasts, you're playing right into the Russians' hands.
Right, and they could be, you know, Russians can be backing someone. This is very different than calling that person a Russian asset.
Well, I think it's really disappointing.
All right, Van, thank you very much.
Well, I tell you what, Hillary really messed up on that deal. Anyway, coming up is an interview that Kyle Bass had with General Spaulding, who spent time as a special, fellow in China and learned Mandarin. And came back, and then he's expanded his knowledge about China. And he has some very interesting things to say about if you attack what the communist Chinese are doing, then you're attacking the culture of China or the good people of China. So anyway, take special note of this and listen to this, because China is very, very dangerous opponent for us. We need to wake up and stop them from stealing our high tech and intellectual properties and so forth. Here we go over this interview with General Spaulding and Kyle Bass.
I'm here with General Spaulding, who's just written a book, Stealth War, How China Took Over While America's Elite Slept. General, it's a pleasure to be here with you today.
Great to be here.
So very few books have been written, I think, unvarnished on what China's really doing, what their grand plan is, what their grand strategy might be, and your journey through China is one that I think people need to hear about. And that starts with the embrace and the hope and the beauty of the people of China all the way back to, I guess, 2002, with you taking Mandarin, learning Mandarin, and basically embedding yourself into China. And then over time, your view of that country and their leadership has changed. So I'd love for you to walk our audience through your time in China. Now, first of all, I'll give the audience a little background. You're an Air Force general. You were a B-2 pilot, I guess are a B-2 pilot, and became the U.S. DOD attaché to China in Shanghai. And tell us about, just walk us through a little bit of your journey into China, taking their language, being immersive, and then when did you start to understand what China's grand strategy really was?
Yeah, so I was selected back in 2001 to be an Olmsted Scholar in China. It's really a wonderful program where three military officers in each branch get selected each year to go live and study abroad in a foreign country for 2 years. And at the time, you have to say, hey, what country do you want to go to? And I thought, you know, first of all, number one, I wasn't going to get accepted as a very prestigious program. But number two, what country would I pick? And as I looked around the world in 2001, the most strategic country that I could think of, whether it's going to be a cooperative relationship or an antagonistic relationship with the United States, that was still yet to be
China.
But it would be China.
Yeah. And
so
that happened to be the year China was ascending to the WTO, right?
It was. And so I applied for the program, got selected, unbeknownst to me, and went home, told my wife, not only are we not getting out of the Air Force like I said I was, we're going to go live in Shanghai. And so we moved to Monterey, California. I learned Chinese over the next year, 2001, 2002, at the Defense Language Institute. And so we moved into Shanghai, Pudong, which is the eastern side, which is the more modern side of Shanghai. It's a new side that the Communist Party built up in the 90s, and got to experience China for 2 years. I studied at Tongji University, which is the premier civil engineering school in China, and traveled all over the country. And it was the most incredible experience. My kids loved it. My wife loved it. I loved it. We got to know the Chinese people, and they were some of the most hardworking, resilient, friendly people that you'll ever meet. And, you know, at the time, I was like, this place is incredible. All of my neighbors were building factories. The Fortune 100 companies were building factories in the Shanghai Special Economic Zone. everybody was doing well economically, not just the foreign companies, but also the Chinese people themselves. They were happy. They seemed to love what was going on. The thing that was interesting, but I didn't challenge, was that all the people told me, hey, you know, we could never have democracy here in China because, you know, the Chinese people really, really can't handle democracy. It would be too chaotic here. You know, at the time, I never thought about it. You never thought to challenge that, you know, particularly since Taiwan was across the strait and they were a very vibrant economy. But, you know, nevertheless, I thought when I left in 2004 after that two-year experience, I told my wife, I said, I'm going to retire from the Air Force and I'm going to come back here
and move back to Shanghai. So what changed? How did you start to see what their grand strategy is as a government, as the Communist Party's grand strategy?
It actually started at the Council on Foreign Relations. So over 10 years later, the Air Force decided, you know, this experience, this language, this culture, that you understand China a lot better than most, and we want to push you to be the Air Force's nominee at some point to be the defense attaché in Beijing. And so there's a process. It's a process to develop you to have the right understanding, knowledge, diplomacy, and other things to be able to do that. So the first step of that process was to be military fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. And that was the first time I was really exposed to the business community, the financial community. And I had a really fateful lunch there with a gentleman that ran a hedge fund in China. And we had a conversation about what's the future of China. And I, you know, believed at the time that their economy was going to stagnate. They had reached the end of their growth model and they were going to have a hard time, you know, establishing a high value added economy going forward. And he said, no, you're wrong. They're going to plateau for a bit and then they're going to take off and then become the most powerful economy and the most powerful country in the world. And I said, that really doesn't make sense. You know, I was still, you know, had a lot of hubris about the United States. You know, we have the best system. We have the best model. We're going to come out of this and there's no way that this is going to be the case. But, you know, that began my education on another part of China that, quite frankly, I didn't realize. And so I moved from there to be the advisor to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs on China. And it was at that time that I began to learn what it was to be a military diplomat. I began to learn about the Chinese government. And more importantly, I began to learn about the Chinese Communist Party. I read documents like the Chinese Communist Party Constitution.
So you weren't coached, let's say, per se, by the U.S. military at the time. They gave you a plethora of resources for you to figure this out on your own.
Actually, no. I was taught in the standard line of diplomats to have the same point of view that the last 40 years had been taking us. And so I was taught that if you want to tell the Chinese about something that's, you know, bad, like concentration camps or forced organ harvesting, always do it in private, never do it in public. And in fact, the Chinese would tell us the same things. Yes, we understand that you guys believe in human rights and democracy and freedom and everything. Just don't talk to us about that in public. Please do it in private. It'll be much better for both of us. You know, if you do it in public, then we have to, you know, be a little bit more effusive in our going against that. But we can certainly listen to your pleas in private. And so we were taught essentially not to air dirty laundry in public. And it really became, you know, as I watched this back and forth, what I was supposed to say to my counterparts at the People's Liberation Army and what they were telling me, we were saying the same things. In other words, they had co-opted the diplomatic language between the two countries to the point where all of our talking points were essentially their talking points. So they had embedded their talking points within ours. And so
that's interesting. You're saying that not only can they control their own narrative within China, and they can use the Global Times and Xinhua and Taichin all over the world to try to control the world narrative about China. You're telling me that they can control the U.S. military diplomat language and control even that narrative when you're over there.
Right. And so one of the things that they'll say, and what Xi Jinping frequently says, and he says it at Davos all the time, is that globalization, we need globalization.
Yeah.
Right? We need to have open markets. We need to have, you know, everybody should be getting along and we should all be trading with each other. And then, so.
No, wait, what he means is he wants global open markets everywhere. He wants to participate, but not at home.
And I didn't understand that until, you know, so this fateful meeting that I, and the, all the people I met while I was in New York actually began to play into my, my learning about what was going on. And so in the fall of 2014, as I'm sitting in the Pentagon reading the Chinese, so there's a Chinese Communist Party constitution and there's a People's Republic of China constitution. Most people don't know there's two constitutions. Now when you think about-
Wait, why is that?
So if you think about a country, and you think about the sovereign of the country. So our sovereign, our State Department acts as a sovereign for diplomatic purposes. In other
Correct.
Words, when it goes across, it represents the sovereign of the United States.
Correct.
When it interacts.
Yeah.
When you talk to the MFA, or when I,
And what's the MFA?
The Ministry of Foreign Affairs in China. Or when you talk to the People's Liberation Army, which is like the Department of Defense in China, you're not interfacing at the government level. You're not interfacing with the sovereign. Now, in the case of the People's Liberation Army, they are actually not a member of the government per se. They are the armed party or armed component of the Chinese Communist Party. And so when you think about a sovereign, what do? They control money. Mm-hmm. Right, they control the police force,
yep.
And they control the military.
Yeah,
right? So essentially, all of those components are completely controlled by the Chinese Communist Party, as is everything else. And so, when you go across and you meet with Xi Jinping as the president, in reality, the component where he decides what happens in the country is actually as the chairman of the Chinese Communist Party.
Correct.
Right? So he's really the chairman. And so when you interface, when our State Department, when Pompeo meets with the Minister of Foreign Affairs, he's not meeting with the sovereign.
Yeah.
Right? You only meet with the sovereign if you go to the Chinese Communist Party headquarters, or some privileged people have been able to go to Zhongnanhai, but of course that's only if you're a special friend to the Chinese Communist Party.
And so haven't you been there?
I have actually been to the Chinese Communist Party headquarters once, and I was taken there by Michael Pillsbury. So I'm probably the only defense attaché that's ever stepped foot in the Chinese Communist Party headquarters.
And what went on in that meeting? This is kind of not really a non sequitur, but I'm very interested
anecdotal
evidence.
So what I found out in that meeting, I was actually quite surprised. The Chinese Communist Party, since the fall of the Berlin Wall and the end of the Cold War, you know, they realized that, hey, Chinese or communist parties are going away. They used to interface on an international basis, on a bilateral basis, with communist parties all over the place, particularly when the Soviet Union still existed.
Right.
Now that all the communist parties are going away, who are they interfacing with? Well, I was surprised to know that our Democratic Party and our Republican Party were going over on junkets to meet with the Chinese Communist Party in the Chinese Communist Party headquarters. So that's one of the things that I learned. It was actually quite shocked about that.
So you saw congressmen and senators on Chinese cultural exchanges being invited into the Chinese Communist Party.
Well, I didn't see them, but that's what they said. Yes, we're doing outreach with your Republican Party. They come over and meet with us, and we're doing outreach with your Democratic Party. They come over and meet. I was actually quite shocked. I did not know that kind of behavior was taking place.
Sure.
But what I was getting in addition to getting trained as a military diplomat, I was also had another education going on. I was reading these documents, the documents of the Chinese Communist Party, and understanding what actually was going on. And so I started to realize that, in essence, if you look at the way the Communist Party works, it is about controlling the narrative. It is about controlling what you think and how you speak about the word China and the Chinese people. So now, even in the United States or in China, when you say China, dot, 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 what comes after that is a Chinese Communist Party talking point. The narrative that says, for example, if you bring up things like concentration camps for Uyghurs or forced organ harvesting or the fact that Confucius Institutes do censorship of speech and suppression of religion on university campuses
in the United States.
The United States.
Yep.
You are being racist, right? That is a Chinese Communist Party talking point. I've experienced it many times. Another Chinese Communist Party talking point is if you say something about, you know, Uyghurs in concentration camps or, you know, the forced organ harvesting, then you just angered 1.4 billion Chinese people. So the Communist Party wraps themselves into this wonderful people and culture and history that I got to know and love in 2002 and 2004 and really takes that mantle right. And says, when you're talking about the evil nature of the Chinese Communist Party,
you're
investing that in the Chinese people. And it's actually quite effective because it shields the Chinese Communist Party from scrutiny because people really can't accept that 1.4 billion people would be that, you know, evil to want to have forced organ harvesting.
Right.
And in fact, what I began to tell my People's Liberation Army counterparts is, look, most people in China don't care what you're saying. Stop saying, I've angered 1.4 billion Chinese. I remember all my friends when I'm walking around in Shanghai. I guarantee you they were worried about living their life. They could care less what you thought as right. The People's Liberation Army.
So you're saying that the Communist Party creates its own safe harbor. And its safe harbor is any criticism of any of the evil that the government is engaging in gives them that safe harbor to just say, you're just a racist.
Because
don't worry about what we're doing over here. You're just a racist, right? Sociopathological behavior.
Yeah, they're burying themselves inside the Chinese people. So because they hijacked China and the Chinese people, only they get to speak for China and the Chinese people. The Chinese people don't get to speak for themselves.
That's very important. Advice coming from General Spalding about China. And so take note of that. That's it. What's coming up next is a short clip of General Mathis at a roast at the Al Smith dinner in New York City. That's annual roast there. And want to take special note, he really, you know, brings some things up and insults President Trump, because they've had some words, you know, in the past and so forth. But I want you to listen to this and note that these generals across the board have never questioned 9/11. In fact, they've used it to manipulate the American public, much like a Pearl Harbor effect. So this is where I question people like General Mathis and others at the very top of not having given us and brought to us a fuller truth about 9/11, what really went on there. So anyway, we've got General Mathis speaking right now, just a short clip.
I do stand before you, as was noted here, really having achieved greatness. I mean, I'm not just an overrated general. I am the greatest, the world's most overrated. And this is in no small part. I will tell you, I owe New York. I owe New York for this because Senator Schumer, have I thanked you for bringing my name up in a rather contentious meeting in Washington where this grew out of. So I would just tell you, too, that I'm honored to be considered that by Donald Trump because he also called Meryl Streep an overrated actress. So I guess I'm the Meryl Streep of generals. And frankly, that sounds pretty good to me. And you do have to admit that between me and Meryl, at least we've had some victories. And some of you were kind during the reception and asked me, you know, if this bothered me to have been rated this way based on what Donald Trump said. I said, of course not. I'd earned my spurs on the battlefield, Martin, as you pointed out, and Donald Trump earned his spurs in a letter from a doctor. So not in the least bit put out by it. And I think the only person in the military that Mr. Trump doesn't think is overrated is who you pointed out, Martin, and that's Colonel Sanders. But none of this can diminish the honor that I feel tonight of being here among all of you wonderful folks in this great all-American city. I, too, Mary Ann, was thinking of my parents as I was coming in tonight. They were married just a couple blocks away in 1946 in a small chapel in St. Patrick's Cathedral. And I have no doubt, believe me, ladies and gentlemen, no doubt that they would be surprised as I was when I received the Cardinal's phone call to come here and speak at this august event. If you told my parents 46 years ago, considering they would have been entitled to drown me at birth had they known how many gray hairs I was going to give them, if you had told them that I was going to be speaking to a room full of clergy, including the Cardinal, their first question would have been, so what did he do? Followed shortly by, 10 Hail Marys are not sufficient, throw the book at him.
These creme de la creme, the elitists, whether they're generals, admirals, or top politicians and multi-billionaires all over the world, are quick to make fun of others. But what I say again is that until these people bring us the truth about 9/11 and a lot of other things. Ron Paul, I will say this about Ron Paul. Is he stood up against the Fed, and he knew that the Fed being privately owned is a big problem. That's why I admire people like Ron Paul. And then Rand Paul did stand with President Trump on this Syrian pullout. I believe that it could have been better organized and there should have been more planning on it before it happened. And I think that's really where President Trump made a big mistake. He did it too impulsively. I am for moving out of these foreign wars and so forth, but we just can't leave the Kurds unprotected like this has resulted in. Now, when we get back to 9/11, there's people out there that have been working on this for years, and there's a great deal of information. And Dave Von Kleist and his wife, former wife, they finally got divorced, Joyce Riley, did a video called In Plain Sight. And it had to do with the Pentagon attack. And they proved without a doubt in my mind that that plane did not hit the Pentagon. The parts of the plane are not there as evidence of the crash of this large 757 into the Pentagon. And there's photographs. I'll put a photograph up on our site that'll show you a real keen shot from one angle, about a 45 degree angle, that will show you conclusively that the story. So what story is correct? We get these stories coming from our government. They're not the total, correct stories. Then we have all these generals and admirals that are leading troops over at these foreign wars, and there's some really good men, really good. I'm a veteran myself, and I believe in going over and defending this country with our lives if necessary. But depending on this 9/11 and that thing set into motion, these foreign wars in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and so forth, and now Libya that Barack Obama carried out, and then with Hillary, and then into Syria. And Benghazi was a stopover point that they had warehouses there at the CIA annex, and they were filtrating the arms from there, Benghazi, into Syria, and McCain and all of them prosecuted the war in Syria, and they went in there without really any basis of law. Say, so that's why Hillary just recently has Tulsi Gabbard went over there, okay, and visited the area, sat down with Assad and talked about the situation. And so now Hillary is saying, oh, you're a Russian asset because, you're over there and you're against us, what we're doing in Syria. Tulsi Gabbard, in her pronouncements in rebuking Hillary and coming back against her on this accusation that Hillary made against her, laid out that these regime change wars and things like that, we've got to just stop doing that. We and our boys, our good American citizen soldiers, are going over there and losing their lives. And it just doesn't make sense when the basis for it has been somewhat of a lie. But anyway, we're going to bring up Dalio, and he's going to give us a little information on a recent speech that he gave about this softening of the international economy. Here we go with Dalio.
What we have, by any measure, is the greatest wealth gap since the 30s. In the United States, the top one-tenth of 1% of the population has a net worth that's approximately equal to the bottom 90%. And so we have a large wealth gap. China's got a large wealth gap. And this, and then with that, we have the political and the greater polarity. And so not the greatest polarity since the 1930s. So, and we have a situation where we don't have much of an ability to ease monetary policy. And then also, like the 1930s, that's why I think it's a point of comparison, is we have a rising power challenging an existing world power in the form of China-U.S. challenges. And as Min and I, we talk about these things regularly. Like we said, there are four kinds of war. Min said, and we agree, there's a trade war. There's a technology war. There's a currency capital war. And there is a geopolitical war. In other words, so that's a phenomenon that's happening at the same time. So internally, we have a lot more conflict. So now if you play that out, you say this cycle is not, this is the best that we get, this moment. We are at the best. The cycle is not going to continue forever, the expansion. You have this sag. Then you have elections and you have politics, which becomes greater extremity. And so on monetary policy, it's not going to be so effective. Imagine if you had a downturn and you have not as effective monetary policy. Then there has to be coordination. So how do you get coordination in this kind of political environment? You have to have a coordination between fiscal and monetary policy to be able to do something. And you can, and then you have to have coordination between the various factors to make decisions on what policy should be. So I think that that's the landscape, broadly speaking, in the world. And we are in that kind of self-reinforcing sag because as one country, as China slows and the United States slows and they all have their headwinds, that makes it not as good for the others who deal with those countries. So that's what the environment looks like to me.
We can make choices as to how much pain we want to take and when we want to take it, which we did after the financial crisis of 2008-09. The risk is that there are imbalances that build up that mean we lose the chance to make those choices and we end up, you've given us a lot of tinder for a fire here. May I ask you, since you know financial markets so well, the IMF has warned about corporate leverage and the $17 trillion of corporate bonds that could be at risk if there's a recession. It's also expressed concerns about this reach for yield that is going on at these very low interest rates. Do you see either of these things as key risks when it comes to generating the kind of market event, the kind of credit event, that we saw in 2007-08?
Let me describe the corporate, okay? What's happened is corporate balance sheets, for a variety of reasons, have borrowed a lot of money. As interest rates went down, a lot of money's available, and the return on equity was higher than the return, the cost of funds. There has been a lot of buying, leveraging up. And there's been a market developing, like in the form of the leveraged loan market, in which essentially you can borrow money with hardly any interest rate and almost the promise that you will never have to pay back principal because you'll keep rolling it over and over and over. Mm-hmm. And they're doing that because of a spread. So the notion is, like, you can borrow the money, and if you don't have to roll over the principal, you don't have any interest, you don't have much in the way of debt service payments. So now you look at that and you say, that's pretty wild. That's pretty crazy. And that is, there are elements of that existing. And of course, but there's the central bank on that who will sort of take care of all that and because they'll provide the money and they'll. And so we have, and then we have the negative interest rate environment. And so those extremities that we're reaching are not such that you're as likely to have a debt crisis in terms of, I look at the debt service payments, but you have a lot of you've reached the limits almost of that being able to happen. And then you have those obligations. So that creates this big sag more than it's likely to create a big bust.
Just recently, this big sag that he talks about, you know, these are subjective terms. But just recently, in the last few weeks, the repo market encountered a liquidity problem. They had to go in, the Fed did. They met overnight and had to infuse $150 billion into the repo market to keep the rate from escalating, you know, too high and to provide the funds that they needed to borrow. So the repo market is a market of overnight lending and borrowing, you know what I mean, depending on which institution needs to borrow or lend. If someone needs to borrow, then there's a lender usually that will step up. But it shot up to 10% recently, and that was extraordinarily high right now. So the Fed came in and saw that and started putting $150 billion into it. And then there was a report that they were putting $75 billion a day into the repo market. And quantitative easing is what we're talking about again. So this does not bode well for bank liquidity. And that's basically what this is saying right now, is that we're beginning to experience, we're at the beginning of a bank liquidity problem, possibly. And these are indications in the repo market and so forth. And I believe Europe has been leading the way on some of this already. They've already started up quantitative easing in their own way in Europe, the European Central Bank. So that is coupled with the UK wanting to get out, and today in the UK Parliament, Boris Johnson experienced somewhat of a setback with an amendment that was passed that would, and then that coupled with another bill passed that he would have to give notice of an extension of the negotiations with the European Union on the exit of the UK out of the European Union. Those two things together have delayed somewhat. And Boris Johnson today on the floor of Commons there said defiantly that he was not going to delay whatever, you know, their UK's exit out of the European Union. So that remains to be seen how that's going to work out. They're alleging, some of the members of Parliament are alleging, that if he doesn't, if he goes ahead and exits out without a plan, without an agreement, this is Brexit without an agreement with the European Union, then he's going to experience some legal problems in the courts of the United Kingdom. So that's ongoing right now. I want to thank everyone out there in our listening audience for supporting us, standing behind us. On November 2nd, actually the 1st, will be 13 years that Charlotte Littlefield Brown and I have been broadcasting. And so we're going to have a special program. That's in a couple of weeks, actually, I believe. Yeah, in about 2 weeks from tonight, we're going to have a special program. And we hope to bring in, we'd like to get Roy Mattress. He was one of our first, guests on our program years ago. Anyway, so God bless each and every one of you. Every life is precious in this world. And every child we need to protect. And what's going on today is not good. And we bless our children for the future of this country. Good night.